Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 161. My name is John. Kickstart my heart. Give it a start. This podcast will be about the recently released Blue Beetle movie. There will be spoilers when I begin talking about the movie itself, but first I want to talk about the history of this legacy character that goes back over 8 decades. I'll also spoil a little bit with the history of the character, so if you're interested in the comic book stories, you may want to at least read the one-shot issue Countdown to Infinite Crisis before continuing. And let me just apologize in advance for any and all mispronounced names. I'm going to try my best to get them right. The character of Blue Beetle, originally published by Fox Comics, goes back to 1939, just a year after Superman debuted. He's had 3 different incarnations, or 4, depending upon how you look at it. The one least familiar to me and to comic fans in general is the original, Dan Garrett, who originally was the son of a slain police officer and became a costume vigilante. Originally with no powers but having a bulletproof suit, he would eventually gain temporary super strength using Vitamin 2X, much like DC's Hourman use Miraclo pills to gain 60 minutes of strength. It was comic books in the 40s, just go with it. In the 1960s, Charlton Comics supposedly got the rights to the character, though there's some question about that, and began publishing new stories, except they added an extra T to the last name, Garrett, and made him an archaeologist, which is considered a different character. Additionally, the original Blue Beetle, Garrett with 1 T, is now considered in public domain, although when he was used by another publisher, they changed the name to Big Blue to avoid any copyright concerns with DC. Regardless, the revamped Blue Beetle with Charlton only lasted a couple of years before he was replaced. And quick side note, whenever you talk about the Charlton characters purchased by DC, you have to mention Watchmen, because the Watchmen characters are based on them. In Watchmen, you had a character named Night Owl, who was actually the 2nd incarnation. The original Night Owl was his retired mentor. These 2 characters are, of course, counterparts for the Blue Beetles. As you may recall from my podcast on the TV series, Peacemaker was another Charlton character changed into the Comedian for Watchmen, while Judo Master was at least a partial inspiration for Ozymandias. I'm hoping for some Nightshade, Question, and Captain Atom in the DCU, just so we can get all these characters together. Legendary creator Steve Ditko, yeah, Spider-Man Steve Ditko, was working for Charlton when he created the new Blue Beetle named Ted Kord. Ted was a former student of Dan Garrett's, and the 2 were investigating Ted's uncle Jarvis, whom Ted learned was trying to create an army of robots to take over the world. It's comic books in the 60s. Just go with it. Garrett was killed in the battle with Jarvis, and Ted becomes the new Blue Beetle, but he doesn't have any powers. Instead, he uses his scientific acumen to create all kinds of gadgets to fight crime using the Scarab motif. And to be honest, the movie has a pretty fair summation of Ted Kord's Blue Beetle. He's like Batman in the fact that he's a rich guy with all these gadgets and vehicles, but where the stoic and brooding Batman works in the dark and uses fear against his enemies, Ted Kord operated in the daylight and was happy and hopeful. This is the Blue Beetle I'm most familiar with, and like most DC fans, I was introduced to him during the Legendary Crisis on Infinite Earths series, after the rights were obtained from Charlton. He's right there on the cover of the first issue, underneath the R in Crisis. The character intrigued me enough to pick up his DC debut series by Len Wein and Paris Collins. And I really enjoyed the two-year run, but characters like that generally don't have series that last a long time. Fortunately, with DC revamping their entire line after Crisis on Infinite Earths, a lot of the big-name characters like Superman, Wonder Woman, Flash, and Green Lantern Hal Jordan were unavailable to use when Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis were given the opportunity to write the new Justice League title. With Batman being the only big name they can use, they decided to go with a bunch of lesser-known or rarely used characters in their lineup, and one of those just happened to be Blue Beetle. If you've never read through their Justice League run, you're really denying yourself a lot of superhero fun. The book included a lot more interpersonal dynamics within the team, including how alpha male hotheads like Batman and Green Lantern Guy Gardner would consistently butt heads with each other. But there were also the friendships that developed. In the fourth issue of Justice League, Booster Gold joined the team, and in their first battle, Booster Gold and Blue Beetle teamed up to defeat the bad guy that had the rest of the team on the proverbial ropes. Soon, the two characters became inseparable, and even when the comedic tones of the book were gone, and DC used the characters in more serious stories, they were still as close of a pair of friends as any you could find in the comics. Ted Kord made his DC debut in Crisis on Infinite Earths, and his story is the prologue to the sequel, Infinite Crisis. In it, Ted uncovers a theft from his company and asks for help from several other heroes who dismiss his concerns. The investigation leads him to former Justice League ally turned bad, Maxwell Lord, who is taking control over Checkmate, a covert operations agency in DC continuity, and is surveilling the superhero community. Lord tells Ted that superheroes are a threat and humanity needs to be prepared to take them out if necessary, and wants Ted to join him. When Ted refuses, Lord shoots him in the head. Now, fans hated what happened, and his is one of those character deaths that, as a longtime reader, I was saddened and disappointed with. Just before Maxwell Lord murdered Ted, the Scarab ended up in the hands of the wizard Shazam. Yeah, the old guy that gave Billy Batson his powers, just like in the movie. During the Infinite Crisis, the Rock of Eternity is destroyed, and the Scarab ends up in El Paso, Texas, and found by Jaime Reyes. The Scarab finally does what it was designed to do, find a host and merge with it. And that's how Jaime becomes the Blue Beetle. He's instrumental in helping the heroes defeat Brother Eye, which is an artificial intelligence created by Batman that had gone rogue. And of course, this is the incarnation of the Blue Beetle that the movie is based on. I don't know how much of the comic book story would have ended up making it into any future movie where Jaime may show up, but in the comics, it's discovered that the Scarab, long thought to be mystical, is actually alien technology that was damaged by mystical power on Earth centuries earlier. It is created by the Reach, a malevolent group of aliens who fought against the Guardians of the Universe, who are the ones who created the Green Lanterns. As part of an uneasy truce, the Reach agree not to try to conquer any more worlds, but had to be invited by a world before they could come to it. The Reach decided to create the Scarabs to travel to other worlds, take over a host, and do benevolent things so the world would invite the Reach in, and then of course the Reach would show their true intentions and take over. between the mystical damage done to the Scarab and Jaime's influence, the Scarab learns the value of individuality and freedom and overcomes its programming to help defeat the Reach. Some of that story is played out in Season 2 of the Young Justice animated series, available on Max, and I highly recommend it. And in comic books, there's always going to be characters resurrected, and although it took a while, Ted Kord has made it back. Ted has become the mentor to Jaime, much like Dan Garrett was in Ted's early character days. So, enough about my history with the character. I'm about to get into the recently released Blue Beetle movie. If you haven't watched it, you really should, before continuing with the podcast, because there will be spoilers. And as always, I will begin with the things I didn't like about it. First off, please, comic book movies, all of you, put something important or strong fan service in your end credit scenes. Stick the silly and pointless stuff in the mid credits. The credits these days are already around 10 minutes long as it is, if not more. Give the people willing to sit through it all something worthwhile. Next, Victoria Kord was a pretty weak villain. I'm not saying Susan Sarandon phoned it in, because she did fine with what she was given, and she did enough to get over the line. Her character was created for the movie, but since it took a while for it to get to the theaters, DC had time to get her into the comics before the movie came out. Still, not a very good villain. Jaime's sister is kind of a pain in the ass. I'm not a fan of characters, or even real people, who complain about their lot in life and then do things that they know will get them into trouble and have a negative connotation, and then complain about the very situation they created for themselves. Not a very likable character. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Every movie in the first three phases of Marvel has one of six plots, except for Captain America: The First Avenger, which is the only unique one of the bunch. I came up with this theory when I realized three of the movies were almost exactly the same. A hero in a superpowered suit fights a villain in a similar superpowered suit because the villain believes he deserves something the hero has. Am I talking about Iron Man, Ant-Man, or Black Panther? Obviously, I'm talking about all three. And now, there are four, because Blue Beetle follows a very similar path with only slight variations, such as the villain in the supersuit is not the mastermind, but a pawn of the mastermind. I mean, really, Blue Beetle is a little bit of a lot of superhero origins. During the Blatcast on The Flash a couple of months ago, I described Blue Beetle as involuntary Iron Man because of the powerful supersuit. But there are other character parallels. Alien technology giving somebody superpowers? Green Lantern. A kid getting superpowers and having to learn how to use them? Shazam and Spider-Man. See, Jaime Reyes came along in 2005, so a lot of the cool hero origin ideas have already been taken. As the ancient king said, there's nothing new under the sun. That's unfortunate. But it can't really be helped until somebody comes up with something truly unique and not an amalgam of other ideas. Jaime Reyes's unoriginal origin is just a victim of being somebody who's too new. By and large, it is a very predictable superhero movie. The hero gets the powers. The bad guy gets the best of him in their first battle. The stakes are raised. The bad guy becomes seemingly unbeatable, but the good guy manages to win out in the end. At no point did I ever think Jaime was going to give into his rage and kill Carapax. Although the one truly unique thing that stood out that I really liked is part of that scene, and I'll get to it later. But it really just followed a similar plot to a lot of superhero movies. I knew when Victoria's forces were trying to take the family, and Jaime comes to try to save them, somebody in the family was going to die, and it was probably going to be either his mom or dad. With all due respect to Gail Simone, it's not just women in refrigerators. Yes, a lot of female characters who are connected to superheroes have met their fictional doom because some villain had it out for the hero. Because for most of the history of comics, the majority of heroes were heterosexual men. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying that's what it is. Yes, some characters were created simply to be the sacrifice for the hero's story. And you can, myopically, believe that it's only female characters treated that way. But if you think that way, then you're forgetting characters like Ben Parker or the entire frickin' planet of Krypton. Hell, Aquaman and Mera's infant son was murdered. For some reason, the death of loved ones is a common theme in superhero stories, and especially origin stories. The stakes were raised for Blue Beetle with the death of his father. So does that make Alberto Reyes a plot point because he was used solely to bring tragedy to the hero's story? Maybe. But does that minimize the importance of a character to the hero's story? No. But you know what does minimize the importance of a character? Ignoring everything else that character is and summarizing them in three words like women in refrigerators, like they meant nothing more. One of the things that had me puzzled in that same scene where the family home gets raided, and I'm glad Jeff DeRay brought this up in the Blatcast, was that this wasn't the police storming the house. It was Cord Industries with Victoria Cord watching. Now, yeah, they did mention in passing that she basically owns the police. But still, how is no one live streaming this? How is this not bringing the attention of other superheroes? And for that matter, as Jeff also mentioned, where's the rest of the neighborhood? We don't see them interacting with the family at all until the end of the movie. Again, maybe Victoria's control over the police has something to do with it and they're too afraid to video what's happening or step out of their houses to protest. But again, there should have been something showing community bonds earlier to have made it all make sense. I get the whole joke about the grandma being a former revolutionary soldier, and that's how she knows how to handle the weapons. But the scene where she gleefully screams, "Death to the Imperialists!" and with lunacy in her eyes, guns down a bunch of henchmen, and then instantly switches back to the calm and determined grandmother, was downright scary. I mean, Jaime is worried about the Scarab not killing anyone, even the bad guys. And Grandma is mowing them down, while Uncle is using the bug to impale them. Zack Snyder caught so much hell for Batman killing bad guys, and in this supposedly family-friendly film, the hero's family is as indiscriminate and maniacal as the bad guys. Sounds like a double standard. And even more of a double standard for the people who don't call it out. Supposedly, this character will be part of the new DCU from James Gunn, even though it's not doing well financially. I'm still not all that excited about what's coming. Yes, I'm happy this character will not be scrapped, and hopefully, if he shows up in maybe the Superman movie, he'll get some more exposure, and people will go back to this film, and it will get some much-needed appreciation. Yes, I'm happy Nathan Fillion is going to play a Green Lantern, just not the Green Lantern I think he should be playing. I'm happy a character like Metamorpho will be making their live-action debut, played by the great Anthony Carrigan. But I'm just not excited about takes on Superman and Batman that are likely going to scrap all the great nuances and corners of the character previously unexplored in movies that made the Snyderverse so much more interesting. I fully expect the new Superman movie to be milquetoast fare, where I never feel like Superman is ever going to lose. He manages to stave off whatever threat comes along without anyone in Metropolis ever getting hurt. And in the end, he flies off with a smile on his face without a scratch on him. There will be no inner conflict. There will be no political conflict. And there will be no fear from Jonathan and Martha Kent about what people will do if they found out their child has powers. In other words, it will not challenge regular moviegoers, or even most comic book moviegoers, to consider how the world would really react if a Kryptonian suddenly appeared. It will be colorful and cheerful and upbeat because that's all that matters to the general public, and probably make $1 billion because that's all that matters to studio executives. It'll be a big old superhero candy bar that tastes great but has a bunch of empty calories. Also, I said it before, and I'll say it again. I am not confident in James Gunn writing and directing a Superman movie. Now, let's be honest. Gunn's success with comic book movies and TV shows have been Guardians of the Galaxy, Suicide Squad, and Peacemaker. Misfits, villains, anti-heroes, and characters who are kind of assholes. Now, that may bode well for a dickweed like Guy Gardner, but it doesn't make me hopeful for Superman or the DCU. And while I appreciate the inclusion of Blue Beetle, to have to wait at least another year and a half for Superman Legacy makes this supposed soft opening of DCU, well, feel like the Griswold's trip to Wally World. Okay, enough negativity. Here are some things that I liked. The family dynamic isn't something you see too much in superhero movies. I mean, sure, you'll have the hero find a family. That's usually with other heroes. The expected trope is to have the hero hide his or her identity from the family in order to protect them and keep them from worrying. In fact, I'm pretty sure Jaime originally kept the secret from his family. But I like this take. Not only does the family witness a Scarab take over Jaime, but they quickly adapt and become a much-needed support for him. All around, it's a pretty darn good cast. Jolo Maradona was definitely a standout. I talked earlier about how this was a predictable superhero movie. It's like a nice dish of vanilla ice cream. That's not a bad thing. Vanilla ice cream is good. It's tasty. My wife loves a little dish of vanilla ice cream, just like a lot of moviegoers seem content with a template superhero movie plot. For me, if you're going to give me a dish of vanilla ice cream, you got to give me some toppings. Gina's fine with eating hers plain, but give me a dish of vanilla ice cream, and I grab some chocolate syrup. Maybe sprinkle on some dry roasted peanuts. I'll even stick a couple of Biscoff cookies in there. With Blue Beetle, the toppings start with the charm of the lead character. Just like with the three Marvel movies I mentioned earlier that have the same plot, this movie was made better, and maybe even saved, by the charm of the hero. I mean, a kid who just wants to give his family a better life, how do you not root for that? The supporting characters all brought their own style to the movie. Bruna Marquezine was a close second with her performance as Jenny. After Victoria dies, Jenny takes the reins of the company and is using it to make things better. Something Robert Pattinson's Bruce Wayne needs to do. You need Wayne Enterprises, dummy. That's how you get those wonderful toys. And while that one scene with the grandma creeped me out, she was still a fun character. Uncle Rudy, another character created specifically for the movie, was also fun, cobbling tech together, showing his ingenuity. Alberto, Jaime's dad, was the kind of positive influence you want for a superhero. So well done with the casting. Legacy is something that gets ignored in most superhero movies because, well, it means a lot of backstory, so they tend to just ignore it. This movie didn't shy away from it, and I hope that bodes well for the DCU. We got to see both Dan Garrett's and Ted Kord's comic-accurate superhero costumes. And of course, if you saw the mid-credits scene, you know that Ted Kord is alive. This, of course, is for a sequel that will likely never get made, but it embraced the history of the character, and I loved it. Also, I've always had an affinity for the Bug, Blue Beetle's ship. It's just so kitschy. I was so happy to see it in the trailer and that it was used so extensively in the final act of the movie. After finding out all the problems the family faced while he was away at college, Jaime tells his sister he wanted to get his family out of the poor neighborhood and live in an opulent mansion. Of course, the next scene is Jaime and his sister at the opulent mansion, but the joke is they're servants. Later on, Jenny, who grew up in an opulent mansion, tells Jaime that while it was nice, she really wanted the loving family like Jaime had all along. I liked that juxtaposition, even if it was unoriginal. The actors pulled it off. Carapax is portrayed as the bitter henchman, willing to slaughter anyone who gets in his way, which is an expected trope of the superhero genre. But at the end of the movie, he recovers his memories, and we see he has been treated basically like a science experiment by Victoria. Jaime was about to allow his anger to overcome him and kill Carapax. But the revelation makes Jaime realize the villain has his own brutal story and spares his life. For a moment. See, the trope calls for the one-dimensional villain to have his life spared and then try one last time to kill the hero before getting his comeuppance. Instead, we see Carapax having his memories unlocked, and knowing all that was done to him, he then overloads his suit to destroy the island, all the dangerous tech inside, Victoria, and himself. The things I liked definitely far outweigh the things I didn't. And I'm happy to say, I left the theater wanting to see this movie again and gladly recommend it to others. When The Flash came out 2 months ago, I was really hopeful. It was a character I had a long history with and one I really wanted to see shine on the big screen. As you know from listening to my podcast about it, I was pretty disappointed. In fact, as time has passed, I've even soured on it more. It just dropped on Mac so I could stream it anytime I want, but I'm just not motivated to do so. Blue Beetle was really the reverse of Flash. I liked the character, but I didn't have a long history with him, and I didn't have any lofty hopes. This movie delivered more. The main character was one you want to root for. The visual effects were very good. I actually left the theater wanting to see it again and bring Gina along with me. Look, no one outside of a DC Comics fan is going to care about Blue Beetle. And yes, the movie is predictable and parallels a lot of other characters. But it's still a fun movie about a hero with a good heart that you can get behind that really deserves more attention than its box office is getting. So, go check it out. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.